Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on April Fool's Day. We managed to avoid the pranks, though, I think. April 1st, 2012, on the premier radio networks all over the country. This is episode 862. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync AppLink. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, helping keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Learn more about the technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at Ford.com/technology.
Well, a good day to you. How are you today? Leo Laporte here.
Well, we began April Fool's with a bang. I don't know what happened. Everything broke. Okay, here we are. Ladies and gentlemen, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Enough about Kelly. That was last month. This is April. Actually, now that was 2 months ago, wasn't it? This is April. And this is not going to be an April Fool's show. I don't like April Fool's. I'm a cranky son of a gun. And I hate it that I can't figure out when I go out on the net what's real. Well, I guess some things are obviously not real. I don't think YouTube is offering DVDs. I don't think so. I don't think Conan O'Brien bought the internet news site Mashable. Although for $3,500 is what he said, but I don't think that's true. Even though Conan is all over Mashable.com. Now that's a pretty good April Fool's joke. They even went orange in honor of the comedian's red hair. I don't think Google, if you go to maps.google.com, has done an 8-bit version of Google Maps for the Super Nintendo NES. I don't think so, although, oddly, it's all quite functional. I don't understand how that is. It's as if they've been working on this for years. Do you have an April Fool's joke you want to check up on if you are curious about something you've read and aren't sure if it's true or not? That's what I don't like. I love it when it's obviously a joke. Then that's funny. Our friends at Revision 3, my good friends, have a very funny video of a Sony laptop that is so small, it's the size of a quarter. The Ultrabook, smallest Ultrabook out there. Now you look at that and you go, I know that's not true. But some things you look at and you go, is that true? So if you've got a question about something you've read today, I will not trick you, I promise. I've done my share of April Fool's jokes, and now I don't like them because I can't figure out what's real or not. 8888 Ask Leo is the number, and that's for real. 888-827-5536. Oh, there's another Google. I think Google folks spend all year preparing for April Fool's. April Fool's is the Halloween of Google. I got some more for you, and I'll tell you about throughout the show. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Your call's next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I hate April Fools. I can't figure out what's real.
I know I said I would.
I can't figure out what's not. I'm real. No jokes today. I'll tell you the truth. Although, you know, I tried to get, and we were unsuccessful. They were all busy. I think it's a busy time for the folks at ThinkGeek. Do you know ThinkGeek.com? It's a great site for geeky gifts. And they also love April Fools. And so this one is, I frequently am confused on ThinkGeek about whether what they're offering is real or fake. In fact, sometimes it's fake but becomes real. A couple of years ago, they had a sleeping bag that was based on, was it The Empire Strikes Back? Where Luke, they're in the frozen wilderness and they're dying and they make a bed inside a dead tauntaun, the warmth of the beast keeping them warm, right? And they offered on ThinkGeek, they offered a Tauntaun sleeping bag with plush guts and everything. And, of course, it was a joke. It was an April Fool's joke, except people liked it so much they ended up making it and selling it. So you never know. Some of these things, though, I think are fake on ThinkGeek.com, like the Keurig K-Cup 5-star meal, gourmet taste for the ramen budget, brew delicious meals in your Keurig coffee machine, including donuts, buffalo wings, tacos, and salads. See, I don't think that's real. I could be wrong. Their stuff is just close enough, like the Hungry, Hungry Hippos for iPad, where you get the plastic hippos and an iPad. Instead of Peeps, they've got Minecraft Creeps, an explosion of marshmallowy flavor. See, I think these are fake, but I could be wrong. The Admiral Akbar Singing Bass. It sings, it's a trap. 8888 Ask Leo. I think some of us are more gullible. I think that's the problem, is it? Some of us are more gullible than others. Let's go to the phones. John in Santa Clarita, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, John.
Hi, Leo. How are you today?
Great. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Before we get started, I'm a driver, not a mechanic.
Okay.
So plug and play is the way I go.
Okay. Easy, you mean.
Okay.
Yes, got it.
Yes. My wife and I travel in an RV all the time.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
We are at the mercy of RV park wireless signals.
Yeah.
And if we're jammed in between large motorhomes or in a spot, the signal seems to degrade either in speed or... and we're looking for some kind of Wi-Fi booster, and I go out on the internet and I see all these antennas and all this other stuff, and I don't know what works or doesn't work. So I was just looking for a little.
Yeah. So the issue in general is that Wi-Fi doesn't do well with metal,
mm-hmm.
and you know, Wi-Fi frequencies are microwave frequencies, 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz. In fact, you know, the higher the frequency, the more likely something is going to bounce off metal. In fact, that's why you can have a microwave oven. Microwave ovens are at 2.4 gigahertz, but the walls, the metal walls, keep them inside, so you don't have to worry. In fact, you'll often notice, at least in the early microwaves, mesh screens in the windows.
Sure.
That's all to keep those microwaves from coming out and frying your brain. So,
sure.
So unfortunately, when you're an RV, in between RVs, what are you surrounded by? Metal.
Sure.
The best way to get to the Wi-Fi signal is line of sight, always is the case. Although, that, you know, it works in a house. You can go through drywall. On the other hand, if you have a house that has metal mesh in the walls, it won't work at all. So I would say your best bet, and there are places you can go to get these improved antennas, but your best bet is not to get an antenna that you sit in the RV, but to, in fact, raise a mast above the RV.
Oh, I see.
Because you want to get above it, above the other RVs, and what you'd like to do is put an antenna that is aimed at wherever that access point is, which is probably the lodge, right, or the office.
Yeah, the office area, sure.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
Some of the higher end places actually zone the park, so you'll have Wi-Fi zones around with local repeaters, I guess they would be.
Right.
That broadcast the system, and you get a much better signal there, of course.
Yeah.
Because you're closer, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's distance, but it's also line of sight. So
I understand.
Yeah. So I'm sure that somebody makes, and I know a lot of people, in fact, make antennas that you can put on your roof and raise, or you can have inside and raise them up above. See Crane makes...
That goes up,
yeah, exactly. You're just basically trying to get above the other RV so you can see the office.
Sure.
And you can, you know, see if you go to seacrane.com, they have an antenna section, Wi-Fi antennas, and you can buy a high-gain antenna. Now, here's the trick on this. Every Wi-Fi access point, I presume you're connecting to, well, now, how are you doing this? Do you have a laptop in the RV?
We have two laptops. One's a little older. It's about 4 years old, but they both have internal antennas.
See,
the other one's a brand-new HP Screamer. So
yeah, that's going to be tricky because, of course, you can't get to the internal antenna.
Right, exactly.
I mean, sometimes you can. I've actually done this. I've opened up a laptop, drilled holes in it, and extended an antenna out of it, but that's not something I would probably recommend.
No.
So there's a couple of ways to do this. You can get Wi-Fi USB dongles, which will replace the internal Wi-Fi adapter. You know what you'd really love to do is put a Wi-Fi repeater in your RV, and that would be attached to the antenna.
Oh, okay.
The trick is making sure that the repeater works with a broad variety of access points. And my experience with this technique is called wireless distribution system. It's something that's actually built into the Wi-Fi spec. But unfortunately, it's been my experience that it sometimes doesn't work. So I'm looking at something called the Bear Extender that the chat room has suggested to me. BearExtender.myshopify.com. Probably you can go to BearExtender.com. And it's a high-power Wi-Fi radio with an external antenna that increases the range of internal Wi-Fi.
Oh, see, there you go.
Yeah. So what you do is it's USB, but what you do is get a longer USB cable and try to get it up on a ladder above the other Wi-Fi. It might even be sufficient, just getting it out of the...
Well, we have vent access, and it's not that hard to run a cable, for a temporary fix. You know, that's not a big deal.
Yeah, Hawk82 is pointing out that in order for WDS to work, the park would also have to enable it. And of course, they're not going to enable it. So
No. You're
going to need something that really, this is interesting. This is a 2 dBi gain antenna, which is not huge, but it might be just enough. So there's one. That's Bear Extender. There may be others as well. I'll let somebody in the chat room help me out because I don't have a lot of experience with the RV places. But that's essentially what you want is some sort of repeater that will boost up the signal a little bit. You could get, you know what you could do is if you got a wireless bridge that would receive the signal and then you could pass it down into the RV. Cellantenna.com is another place, according to Unity Blue in our chat room. Interesting question. This is a problem people even have in their houses. You know, metal is not, it's not good for Wi-Fi. So you're going to have to move things around, and sometimes you even have to pass wires through the walls, things like that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thanks, Chris. He's gone. He's gone. He's gone. Chris Marquardt has left the building. Ciao, baby. With colleagues working from home? You know, I should probably take this opportunity to talk to you a little bit about, speaking of apps, we're going to talk about apps in just a bit, AppLink on Fords, right? You know, we're a big fan here of a Ford Motor Company, and we love the AppLink. Let me see if I can find. I got Sync. I got Sync Services. I got a lot of Ford. I'll just use the Sync lower third for the time being. Because it is part of Sync, AppLink. So this is something very cool that Ford decided to do. And I remember when they were telling me about it, they said, look, you know, we understand that the car is not going to be updated as often as your iPhone or your Android phone, as your smartphone. So we figured out a way to make smartphone apps tie into the car. This is called AppLink. It's an API. So programmers who write apps can make sure they work with Sync. So the smartphone apps can now be controlled using the voice. It means you keep your hands on the wheel, your eyes on the road. This is what Ford is all about, is getting you connected, but without compromising safety. And that all the studies that Ford does and others do show that as long as you've got your hands on the wheel, I now do it down here because my son said, Dad, it's not 10 and 2 anymore. It's 9 and 3 or 8 and 4. Keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes glued to the road, you're going to be a much better driver. But you still want to, I don't know, listen to Pandora? No problem. You actually press the button in the steering wheel and you can call up Pandora from your phone and have it play. You even have thumbs up, thumbs down, skip song, remember this song, bookmark this song, all the features. There's new apps too. There's NP. Wow, since we did this last, there's new ones. iHeartRadio, that means you can listen to me. NPR in your car. Open Beak, that's for tweeting, Slacker Radio for other podcasts, Stitcher 2, and something called Sync Destinations, which gives you navigation and directions through the smartphone. That's cool. The iHeartRadio Thumb Play service lets you use simple voice commands to find your save stations. You can actually now say, play Leo. You could skip the next song, give a song a thumbs up. It's fantastic. Ford has a Sync mobile application developer network that lets developers contact Ford about their apps and work with them, saying this would be great for Sync, and Ford can work with it. Look, you got to see this in action. Go to your Ford dealer, drive one today, or visit Ford.com/technology, and you can expect to see more Sync-enabled mobile apps that go along for the ride in Ford vehicles. It's growing all the time. I think that's really cool. Ford.com/technology. Very, very neat. The point is not taking your hands off the wheel, right? Or your eyes off the road. And that's something that Ford has, I think, that's unique to them. There is a lot of car manufacturers are trying to figure out how to do this. But, boy, you know, I look and I see dashboards now. They have hundreds of buttons. This is a fun one. This is from Google and NASCAR together. It's called, if you go to google.com/racing. Remember, Google was doing those, in fact, still does. They've got many, many miles now. I think 500,000 miles on their autonomous vehicles, the cars that drive themselves. And if you go to google.com/racing, they say, introducing our autonomous race car partnership with NASCAR. And they've got a NASCAR driver with his hands out the window as the car drives itself. I'm steering lucky, it says on the back. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that's such a good idea. Pretty funny. Fortunately, because this could almost be true, right? Until you really think about it. What's the point of a NASCAR race if the driver's not driving? And then at the bottom it says, surprise, as you might have guessed, Google Racing is an April Fool's joke brought to you by Google and NASCAR. And while we won't be, and see, Google is a little sneaky because they use these April Fool's jokes essentially as ads. And we won't be providing self-driving cars to compete in the races. We do look forward to working with NASCAR on future projects. They're very clever. Very clever. Patrick, I have one more thing to say to our previous caller who wanted to increase the range of his Wi-Fi. There's a company called Jeffatech, JEFATECH.com. I'll put a link in the show notes, with Wi-Fi solutions for RVs. And what you get is a long-range antenna kit that you could, yes, put on a ladder and raise up above the RV that comes down to a USB device, which you then plug into a computer. And the computer then can be used as a Wi-Fi access spot for the rest of the computers in the RV. So it's not expensive. The Wi-Fi to USB adapter with the rubber duck antenna is $49.95. You might want to get a better antenna. That's there are other choices. They also have longer cable. So this is a good one. Jeffatech. And we'll put a link in the show notes for you. JEFATECH. But our show notes, it's easy to find. Just remember techguylabs.com. And James DeRuvo's in those show notes right now, and he's pasting busily, typing and pasting as we speak. Patrick in Guelph, Canada. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Leo. Great to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
Leo, I got a comment and a question.
Yes.
The comment first, I just want to let you know that you have inspired me to start up what we call the tech group in our retirement community. We used to have a computer club, which was all about Windows PCs, and there'd be presentations that our coordinator of the club would prepare, spend endless hours on. We had a less active Mac group. But the coordinator of the computer club died quite suddenly, and the group kind of went into limbo.
Yeah.
And I had the idea that maybe what we could do is expand the scope of it to cover all kinds of technology, as you say, anything with a chip in it, and avoid having to prepare presentations by just answering questions. So that's what we do. Myself and two to three other people that know maybe a little bit more than the rest of the people in the group, we sit at the front. We have a couple of a big screen TV and a projector that we can connect some a Mac and a PC up to, and we just answer questions on all kinds of different things.
What a great idea. I think that's a brilliant idea. I think, you know, I've always been a big fan of user groups, but user groups miss a bet when they stick with Windows PCs. That, of course, was the number one interest for years, but really, we've gone far beyond that. And a lot of, especially when you're working with older people, a lot of people now want iPads. They want to, everybody wants to know more about cell phones. Those are appropriate for user groups, too. That's a great idea.
Yeah, and I should point out that iPads are being gobbled up like crazy in our community. I can't believe the number of people who bought iPads.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good choice for a lot of people.
Yeah. On to my question. I've been a long-time PC user. I've got a desktop and a laptop. A few months ago, I bought a MacBook Air, initially to replace my laptop, but ultimately what I want to do is replace the desktop, which has a lot more files on it. My plan is to connect it up to my existing 21-inch display. Maybe if I get really ambitious and have enough money, I'll get a cinema display from Apple. But because the MacBook Air has got a limited amount of space,
right.
I've got 128 gigs on the solid-state drive.
Right.
What I want to do is connect it up to a Thunderbolt drive and use that as my main data drive. But the problem I'm looking at is doing backups. I currently, on my existing PC desktop, I have an external drive and I use Carbonite. And so I do backups to the external drive just because that's handy and fast, but Carbonite, of course, is working all the time. But if I had this Thunderbolt drive connected up to the MacBook Air, I'm going to need another drive then to back it and what's in the MacBook Air's solid-state drive up. But Carbonite will not do backups of external drives from a Mac.
Okay, couple of things. First of all, I would suggest not using a Thunderbolt external drive because capacities are low and prices are high. In fact, I've been testing them. They're nice and fast. And, of course, now that you have a MacBook Air and you've got an SSD, a solid-state drive inside the Air, you're spoiled, aren't you? But the truth is, for a data drive, an external drive does not need to be that fast. So you'll continue to use the internal drive on the MacBook Air as the boot drive. Have the operating system and apps on that. Data drive's an external drive. It needn't be a Thunderbolt drive. It can if you've got a lot of money, but it needn't be. You're right. Unfortunately, Carbonite, which does now offer external drive backup plans, does not yet offer it for Mac. That's coming soon, however. Until they do that, my suggestion would be just get, instead of one highly expensive small Thunderbolt drive, and by the way, the Thunderbolt drives don't even come with the cable. That's an additional $50 from Apple. Thunderbolt is really only for people who have more money I shouldn't say that. I was going to say that. Have a need for speed and lots of disposable income. How about that? I'm skeptical about Thunderbolt in general. We see very few Thunderbolt drives. The fact that the cable doesn't come with the drive in most cases, but you got to spend another $50. You know, I have a 128 gigabyte Thunderbolt drive. I think it's $600. For $600, you could buy 4 2-terabyte drives. It's crazy. So my suggestion is, instead of doing what you're thinking of doing, get a single USB external drive. That'll be fine, fast enough. Actually, get two. Get, say, 2 500-gigabyte drives. Use those as your data drive. Take one to work or, you know, somewhere off-site. That's your off-site backup. Every once in a while, swap them.
So you're just saying that because that's my data drive, that that's going to have everything that I really need to back up. And
right.
And I just...
Actually, you will need another. I'm sorry. Yes, you. So I should. I didn't give you the right specs. Let me draw a diagram in your mind here. You've got your MacBook Air. By the way, the MacBook Air, if you hook it up to an Apple display, $999, but then you get 27 inches. It's kind of nice. You leave the Air closed. The Apple display has a power cord and a USB cord. You just plug it in. It actually, if you get the Thunderbolt display, you just plug in the Thunderbolt port. Thunderbolt does everything. That now display has hooked up to it your external drives. So your Air, you walk around. When you get home, you plug it in, and you don't even open it up. It is now a desktop computer with external drives, external monitor, external keyboard and mouse. Very easy. Hang on, I'll explain more in a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Mighty sound. Here I am to save the day. That means that Mighty Mouse is on the way.
Hee-haw.
Yes, sir, when there is a right.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, April Fool's 2012. And yes, the folks at Google have way too much time on their hands, clearly. If you Google really advanced search, there's a new Google search, really advanced search, which allows you, it gets more advanced as you go down the page. It allows you to find pages with all these words, any of these words, words almost but not quite entirely unlike. Find pages with rhyming slang for. Find pages with this exact word or phrase whose sum of Unicode code points is a Mersenne prime. It goes on and on and on. You can narrow your results by font, loan word origin, pages in a link graph G with chromatic number Y of G of at most, content that is true, that's a good one, in the objective sense, in the subjective sense, in the constructivist sense, in the empirical sense, in the tautological sense. Wow, that is just silly. You can also tickle a unicorn or search by odor. There are, of course, many pages you can go to that talk about April Fool's Day 2012. There's one, April Fool's Day on the web.com, that has or purports to have a link, user-generated links to every face, April Fool's joke everywhere, and there are a lot of them. I really wish we just had a little box I could enter in a URL and say, is this a joke? That's what we need. Just say, is this a joke for you? There's it a down for me. There is it a down for me. That's a web page where you can say, is it down for me or everyone else? Is it a joke for me or everyone else? That would be good. That would be useful. So we were talking to Patrick in Guelph, Canada, who has a very nice setup, or wants one anyway. I haven't done the calculations on the cost yet, Patrick. But so you've got a MacBook Air, great start, but you also want desktop. And I think that is a very good way to go. The new MacBook Airs, you could make basically as powerful as a desktop with an i7 in them and lots of power. So I would say if you really wanted to do this, buying the Apple Thunderbolt monitor for $999 would allow you then to sit down with your Air without opening it up. This is one of the nice features of Apple's connections. You pop in the power, you pop in the Thunderbolt, and you now have a desktop in effect because you've got a screen. The mouse and keyboard can be connected to that screen. The screen has USB ports. You could also connect Thunderbolt devices if you really wanted to, but my suggestion would be use an external data drive, have it there, and then have another drive that you back up to and rotate that third drive by bringing it off-site. That way, it kind of duplicates the effect of Carbonite. There are some differences. For instance, it's not automatic. You have to, remember to back it up. You could use something like Super Duper that would back it up on a regular basis, something like that.
So I have my data drive, and then I have a second external drive, but yeah. You're suggesting I have two of those and alternate them from time to time.
Take one to work, leave one there, and that way you get them off-site. And then the program that I think is very good for this kind of thing, there's a couple on the Mac. Super Duper is excellent, and ChronoSync would be one that could run in the background every few hours to make sure that you're up to date, and it only backs up the stuff that's been changed. ChronoSync. That would be, those three drives would be less than a single smaller Thunderbolt drive.
Well, that's true. Now, when I saw that Carbonite wouldn't handle external drives on a Mac, I was looking for alternatives, and I looked at CrashPlan.
Yep, that's
a
good
thing about it.
Yeah, they're very good. Excellent company.
Okay, so that's a possibility,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, there are other ways to do external drive backup. They're all more expensive, of course, because the potential for cost, a lot of storage goes up as you start backing up external drives. Carbonite they offer it currently for Windows only, but they will offer it for Mac, I'm told. Another one that's popular is Backblaze. Backblaze. And I've used Jungle Disk, which is a little more difficult, roll your own, that uses Amazon's S3 for storage.
Yeah, I used to use it, and I found it, it didn't work that well for me. Kept getting hung up and saying it wouldn't back things up, and it was a little too technical as
well. It's pretty tricksy, yeah. So a Backblaze or crash plan would be good choices, I think.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for the call, Patrick. Yeah, I mean, you can make an offsite backup. It doesn't necessarily have to be the internet. In fact, if you're backing up a lot of data, like terabytes of video and stuff, an offsite backup is probably should be just a big old hard drive that you take somewhere. Every once in a while, you know, you swap out. We're going to take a break, come back with more. Anthony's waiting to get on the line from Orange County. He just got a patent and is trying to figure out how to get something manufactured. I don't know if I can help him, but I bet you our audience can. We've got a great group of people in our chat room. You can go there, too, by going to techguylabs.com, techguylabs.com. And you'll also find links to the show notes as we speak. James writes everything down and makes sure everybody has all the links they need. He also puts in all the news stories and everything you'll find. And even at the end of the show, thanks to Kyle Benham, we get a playlist of the music we've played. All at techguylabs.com, along with a chat, downloadable audio and video of every previous show, and more. All free, too. Anthony in Orange, California, Orange County, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Anthony.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. You had to check the clock. Yes, we just made it. It's morning.
Yes, you did. I had a need, and I couldn't find it.
Oh.
And in my... In my bizarre way, I ended up accidentally developing something that can be used in all Apple computers, iPods, iPhones, and we obtained a patent. It took me about a year, but I obtained the patent. And now I need to have it manufactured. Can't be manufactured in the U.S. The research I've done, it's not cost-effective. So I need to know where and who do I find to manufacture this product for me?
That's an interesting question. You know, inventing a product, you're going through this process. This is exactly the process you have to go through to be a successful inventor. And I should also say there is a considerable dollar expenditure involved at all as well. And I know this because I've met many an inventor who has a great idea and says, I want to bring this to market. So the first step, of course, is to patent it. That's probably the easiest step. You've done that. Next step is we got to make it, which means we got to make prototypes, and then we have to find a manufacturer. You're going to have to lay out some cash to make it. Now you've got 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 units. The next thing we got to do is get them back to the U.S., probably in a shipping container. And then we have to figure out how we get it to the customer. Are we going to sell it ourselves? Are we going to do our own commerce? Are we going to try to get it in stores? Prepare to spend at least $100,000 to getting to market. And it is a big gamble. It is a big gamble. You know, certainly you can do this, and there are places you can go. China sources. Is a manufacturer source in China online. You Google it, China Sources, and it has lots of companies in China that will make stuff. But that seems to me the least of your worries at this point. Where are you going to get the cash? How are you going to tell them how to make it? Do you have a prototype? And then how are you going to sell it? I would solve all these problems at least on paper before you even take the first step. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I don't make April Fool's jokes. Don't expect anything from me. I'm old and cranky. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It's kind of an endless supply of Google's April Fool's jokes. I've just found, thanks to our chat room, we're going through them all. There's a Gmail tap joke. There's a Chrome multitasking joke. I think it looks like what Google did is they said to every single division, you need to have an April Fool's joke. And ultimately, you know, I guess it's probably good for Google because they're all essentially ads for the Google products in the long run, aren't they? But boy, you got to wonder if these guys are spending a lot of time. There's movies, you know, big elaborate pages and presentations. Maybe it's just a marketing exercise. Maybe they get the interns to do it. Maybe it's, as N5GM says in our chat room, team building. Steven's in Roscommon, Michigan. Hi, Steven. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Well, sir, it's an honor to talk to you. I've been watching you since Tech TV.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm still here.
I'm moving to a two-story townhouse, and I have an entry-level Netgear router. I'm wondering if it's worth upgrading to the latest and greatest. And I have the router that has the WPS button on the front. And I'm wondering if that's do you really think it's worth upgrading and getting out of that security hole?
Yeah, so what he's talking about, we've talked about before, but I'll mention again, to make it easier to implement security on your Wi-Fi router, about a year and a half ago, all the Wi-Fi companies, the router companies, started to put this WPS, Wi-Fi Protected Security, or Wireless Protected Security button on the router. And you press the button, and then it just sets it up for you. Oh, it's so easy. And you have an 8-digit PIN. There's a problem, though. The 8 digits never change. And that 8-digit PIN, the way they implement it, is actually really just a 4-digit PIN. And so it's fairly easy to crack. And once cracked, all your security is broken. So instead of being wireless protected security, this is wireless unprotected security. It doesn't work. You can disable it on many routers, although the Linksys routers from Cisco have a disable button. But it doesn't disable them. You have to get a firmware update. Not all of them have been updated. Now, you said you have a D-Link.
Netgear.
Sir. Netgear, I'm sorry. I think you can check online. I'll put a link in the show notes to the list of routers that have problems with WPS. Does it have a pin on the back, an 8-digit pin on the back?
Not if I can see.
If it rotates pins, in other words, if every time you press the button, it gives you 2 minutes to access it with a new pin, then you're okay. If it's always the same pin, that's not so good.
Okay.
But your bigger question is, can I get upstairs?
Yes, that's the question.
Is it an N? Is it 802.11B?
Yeah, it's the very first one. I think it's a draft N.
Draft N. Okay. Well, the draft N for most was the same. What I would do, here's what I would do. I would look and see if Netgear's offering a firmware upgrade for that router. And if it is updated, that'll make it... In all likelihood, that'll make it fully N compliant. You know, upgrade it'll go from draft N to N, the standard.
Okay.
N does make a difference in terms of distance. So I would guess that you probably don't need to retire that router, but there would be a couple of things I would encourage you to do. One is to update it to the latest firmware. Two is to make sure that doesn't have that WPS flaw. And if it does, disable WPS. I think all the Netgears allowed you to disable WPS.
Okay, sounds great.
So I wouldn't get rid of it unless it doesn't work. And if it doesn't work, get a better one. There are, you know, Netgear makes fine routers, D-Link too. I'm not crazy about Linksys. But there's often, you know, it's interesting. If you live in an area where there are a lot of Wi-Fi signals, getting a good Wi-Fi router is more critical than if you're the only Wi-Fi signal in the area or there's only one or two. Because the better routers are better at handling interference, at finding an open channel. In fact, here in our Brick House studios, we have so many Wi-Fi signals. We originally used, enterprise-grade routers, but they weren't good enough, and we actually had to upgrade to much more expensive. We were using Cisco's, John. I think we were using Cisco's, and we've upgraded to HP Enterprise routers, which cost, you know, 5 times more than the Cisco's routers did. You would think, well, Wi-Fi is Wi-Fi. No, it's not. There's a lot of difference in implementation. At home, I use a more expensive router. Maybe I'm buying into the snake oil. I use the Apple Airport Extreme. But I do think it does a better job in a crowded area than other companies. And if you're not in a crowded area, you're probably all right. Now, this WPS thing is a big issue because of the flaw, and it's a fairly easily exploited flaw. Your router security does not work. So people can get on your network. They can spy on your content because basically they can crack your password, your WPA password. So if you're using Wi-Fi, there's two steps. One is, of course, turn on WPA. Actually, if you have it, WPA2, Wireless Protected Access, turn off WPS. Oh, that's confusing. A is A-OK. S stinks. How about that? You can remember that. Turn on WPA, turn off WPS. And if you're in a Linksys router, just throw it away because you can't, in most of cases, turn off WPS. They've now just started offering updates that let you disable it. but they haven't fixed it yet. Don in Orange County, Leo Laporte. That's an Orange County day. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Don.
Hi. I have a media, HP media desktop, Pavilion M9515Y. That's it's always been attached to an APC UPS, but we had a power outage. After that, the display was frozen. No response to the keyboard or mouse. I finally pressed the blue power button. This is the blue light on top of the unit. It then turned yellow, which I'd never seen, and then didn't do anything else. So I finally pressed the button continuously until the unit turned off. Now, if I press the power button again, the system sounds like it's on. In other words, the fan noise is present, but nothing else happens. So I'm not sure what's going on.
Well, the first thing, since you have an APC surge protector on there, most of those surge protectors come with insurance. I'd contact them because your computer has been damaged. And it wasn't damaged by you turning it off. Don't worry about that. The computer, when the monitor froze, the monitor actually didn't freeze. What happened is the computer stopped working. You couldn't...
I double-checked by hooking up the monitor to my laptop, and it seemed fine.
Yeah. So. But all the monitor's saying is nothing's happening. I'm getting a signal, but I'm not, the mouse isn't moving, your keyboard's not moving, you can't shut down. That means the computer froze up. And when you press that power button, you actually were telling it to shut down. You waited, though, a while after it went yellow, right?
Yes, I did. I waited about 10 minutes.
Yeah. So it's fine to do what you did, which is continue to hold it. That's the forced shutdown. At that point, nothing's being written to the disk. The whole computer is dead. So something's wrong now. We don't know what's wrong. You could probably bring it to the shop. It may just be a bad video card. It could be, who knows? We don't know. But it won't. You know, the fan comes on. That's a good sign. Means probably the power supply is okay. But it also could be the motherboard was zapped. It could be your whole computer's shot. But the only way to tell, I can't tell that. The only way to tell that is to bring it into a shop. And APC is a good company. They do back up their, you know, I'm pretty sure you'll have an insurance policy on that. And you call them and say, we had a lightning strike and it didn't work.
Yeah, unfortunately, I had it plugged directly into the unit, directly into the wall, because they have that gotcha on there. If you have anything plugged in indirectly, then the insurance does not apply.
That's right, because lightning can get in from anything that's attached to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, your insurance does not apply.
Well, all I can say is thank God for carbonite.
Good, you had a backup. Not so bad. You know, 3 years, I'll make it feel better. 3 years, that's an old computer. You get a great, much better computer for less than you paid 3 years ago. Time to replace it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK. Leo, that's the phone number. Josh in Amarillo, Texas, you're next. Hey, Josh.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Excellent. I got through to you. This is awesome. This is my first time. I love your show.
It's not easy to get through, so congratulations. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. You're the best thing since sliced bread in the tech world.
Oh, thank you so much.
Hey, I've got this setup that I really love and was able to make me a cord cutter, but I'm having a little bit of trouble with my tuner card on my PC end of it. I use an Xbox in my living room, and I have my computer recording over the air, free HD, in my computer room, and then I just stream it to my Xbox using Windows Media Center. Windows Media Center supports two tuners. I have an onboard, which works great. I plug in a USB tuner, and it seems to freeze up, bog down, and kind of not do what it needs to. And lots of times it just needs to be completely rebooted on the computer end. And I'm just kind of wondering, what does the horsepower on like a TV tuner recording sort of thing, what does the processing? Is it, my computer's old. It's kind of like, it's 6 years old. I got a dual core AMD in it.
So are you recording two things at the same time?
Yes, I can record.
Yeah, that's where you're gonna see a problem. But, you know, you if you were watching one channel and recording another channel, even an older computer, as long as it could record, as and apparently it can, isn't going to have a problem. It's recording two things at once. It's pretty challenging.
Okay, what is it that it challenges? The tuner card?
Think of all the data. It's just doing a lot of work. It's not the tuner card. It's the fact that you've got two separate video signals coming in that the computer has to put on the hard drive.
Okay.
Right.
So would you recommend having like a more powerful processor?
A processor that's better and a faster hard drive both should make a big difference.
Okay. All right.
So that's really the issue. I mean, and do you have a problem if you're watching one show but not recording it and recording another one? Does it bog down then?
No, not really.
Yeah. So there you go. That narrows it right down there, right? So it's really when you're trying to record two video streams. Now, you could record lower quality. That would help.
Uh-huh.
So you could try that and see if that makes things better. If it does, it absolutely confirms my hypothesis because, you know, that video's a lot of data. You know, you're talking about a gigabyte an hour of data, and it's got a, and it's a single hard drive, so it's going, it's doing two things at once. First thing I would do that would be the cheapest would be see if putting in a faster hard drive speeds things up.
Okay. Yeah. I never thought about that, writing to the hard drive.
Yeah. It's got to do a lot of that. Yep. So it's certainly not the fact that you've got two tuners, since you can watch one tuner and record a show. It's when you're recording two shows at once. Yeah. Faster hard drive, maybe record each. I don't know if Media Center will let you do this. Record the streams to separate hard drives. Can you do that?
I've only got one. Well, I got an external.
I wonder. Maybe the chat room knows. Does Windows Media Center let you say, take the output of this tuner and record? No, you have to record the same drive. So that's really the issue.
Yeah. And that would be even slower over USB connected.
You have to understand that the USB is compressing because it has to compress the signal before it comes down that USB pipe. But I would presume that the company that made the USB tuner is, you know, made it fast enough to compress the data. So actually, USB might actually be less of a problem than the tuner, onboard tuner, which is probably sending higher bit rate video to you.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Sounds good.
So that's probably the problem, a faster computer, but would certainly help, but maybe just a faster hardware. Remember, the encoding in general is done by the video capture card, not the CPU. So it doesn't necessarily mean a faster processor will make a difference. I mean, it always helps, but I think a faster hard drive make the biggest difference. People forget how much I/O, we call this, input-output, can affect the speed of your computer. And that's why when you put in a solid-state drive, which is a very fast hard drive, people are often just blown away by the speed improvement on the computer. It turns out the computer wasn't slow because the processor was slow or the video card was slow. It's because the I/O, the hard drive, was slow. Now, in your case, Josh, you probably can't put a solid-state drive in that computer if it's an older computer. You need to have a more modern computer to take advantage of everything. Let's see here. Moving on Actually, coming up in just a second, at 33 and a half after the hour, our photo guy, Chris Marquardt, we're going to do a photo review. So if you submitted a picture for our photo assignment, we'll take a look at three of the best in just a bit. Now it's Walter in Huntington, West Virginia. Hi, Walter. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Nice to speak to you again.
Nice to talk to you.
Well, I got myself a new iPad, and I'm trying to decide whether I should get onto a 3G data plan, which for 3 gigabytes, it costs $30. But I really don't know how much data I can get using 3 gigabytes. For instance, I was wondering, your Saturday or Sunday podcast, how many gigabytes would that use?
Ah, good question. Those are about 100 to 150 megabytes if you just get the audio. When you go to video, you're big increase in size.
Okay.
So you could easily, with 3 gigabytes, listen to all my shows. Is this going to be your only internet access? You're not going to have any Wi-Fi or anything like that?
Well, I can go to the local library and use
right.
their Wi-Fi.
But this will be your home internet access.
It would be, right. It would be.
Yeah, 3 gigabytes is not a huge amount. You may find that you run out. It's hard to predict, but you're right to kind of try to do these back of envelope calculations. Email usually isn't very big unless you have friends that send you large attachments, but email usually is not a lot. Web pages can be more than you think. Nowadays, web pages can get quite heavy, but really it's video, watching the live video stream or downloading video that's going to be bad. In fact, if you watch Netflix, you'll go through that 3 gigabytes in about a weekend.
Oh, really? Okay, well, I don't watch that.
don't be watching Netflix.
I won't. You know, this iPad is great. I mean, that camera is just super.
I agree. I use the iPad for everything, especially since I dunked my iPhone. I use the iPad for everything, and I love the new camera. I think they did a great job. I love the screen. And yes, this LTE or 3G, I don't know if you have LTE where you are, but the 3G is great because you're always connected. But use it, especially if you use it as a hotspot, you're going to use it. I wouldn't worry about email, a little bit of surfing. It's really consuming video that's going to kill you.
Okay, good. You know, I was able to take a photograph of a page in a magazine.
Yeah.
A really close-up photograph.
And you can read it.
Clear.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a scanner.
Yes, right. It's great.
Yeah, I use it all the time. Really I did this exact same thing this morning, Walter. I'm going to go shopping after the show. I took a picture of a recipe in a recipe book. Rather than write down every ingredient, I just used my iPad, took a picture. I'll take it to the store, and I have my list.
Right. There's one thing I want to mention. I bought a white iPad.
Yeah.
I tried to take a picture of a picture in a frame. Well, the white reflects from the glass.
Oh, that's not good. So, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt is here, our photo guy.
Hello, sir.
The podcaster. Hello, Chris. Behind the Tips from the Top Floor podcast, does workshops all over the world. In fact, just completed a lighting workshop. We'll ask him about that in a second. And you'll find him at chrismarquardt.com. And here most Sundays to talk about photography. Actually, we're going to review our assignment. Chris, so you just had a lighting workshop.
Yeah, we had a group of 14 people, and we spent time with available light and with strobist style, like small flash lighting and bigger studio kind of setup. So learned a lot of stuff, and I learned a lot of stuff every time I do these workshops because people ask really good questions. So we had a ton of fun there.
That must be so much fun. We have, and by the way, if you want to know about his workshops, discoverthetopfloor.com.
Yes.
And you can find them on. Are you going to do the summer workshops in the U.S. again?
I will be in Washington, D.C. I will be in San Francisco. I'm going to go up to Canada, to Toronto and Vancouver. So summer is going to be,
excellent.
Pretty good time to learn about photography. Excellent.
Now, one of the things we like to do with Chris, he always gives us great tips, but, it means nothing unless you go out and take pictures. So what we like to do every month is give you an assignment, give you 4 weeks to fulfill the assignment, and then put your pictures up on the Tech Guy group on Flickr to illustrate that assignment. And then every month we'll take a few pictures and take a look at them. And I know it's a little weird to talk about pictures on the radio, but to explain why these are interesting and so forth. Now, this month's assignment, the task was to illustrate the word or concept language.
Yeah, and I really like what came back. People sent in pictures of signs and some were like of multilingual signs, and some used coins from different countries to illustrate the word, and it was a crossword puzzle. Someone's even sent in a page of programming language, which is language too. Morse code, kind of more of an alphabet than a language. Even one picture about body language. So I really like how people look at those terms from all different sides, they think outside the box, and that really works well on these assignments. So we have three that I want to take a quick look at.
Yeah.
The first is by Southern Pixel Albie. And
I love this one.
Well, if you read the note, it's 15-month-old Nola Marie learning American Sign Language as a second language.
So she speaks. So she's not deaf, but she is learning ASL.
Yes.
And but that's really kind of cool because 15 months is really at the beginning of any language acquisition.
Right.
And it's so cute.
And it's not just the cute pictures and the whole topic that it's about, but I just like the way of the presentation because people always look like, okay, this is one picture, but if you put pictures together in, let's say, in a diptych of two pictures or a triptych or even four pictures, you can really tell a different story. So presenting pictures this way is really a nice way to help multiple pictures tell one story.
Albie's taken four different pictures, captioned each with the word that she's speaking, and put them in a single frame. You know, there are apps to do this on the iPhone and the iPad and on sites like Instagram. You see a lot of people using frames and framing. I think it is a kind of a neat way to make a single picture tell a story. It's almost like a comic book. So she's saying food by touching her lips, please by touching her heart, yum. I don't know what yum is, just by eating, I guess, and thank you by touching her lips. And it's really neat. I really like that. I like. Good choice. So thank you, Albie, for submitting that one.
Yeah, thank you. The next one is by Rolo Rummage, and it's called Talking with Trees. And the reason this jumped at me is, well, first of all, it's very colorful. So it's apparently an exhibition of knitting around trees. So it's,
I don't know how you knit around a tree, but...
I looked it up. It's called tree socks.
Socks, yeah. So these are beautiful knit socks around real big trees.
It's a little big socks.
Yeah, it's a little forest, and they're very colorful, very pretty. And then there's a little one in a coat walking around and looking, and she's touching one of the trees in one of the tree socks.
And that is what I really liked about this picture. It's telling a story. It's this little girl walking up to this one tree and touching it, because it is really something that is probably pretty much outside of what she normally sees. I mean, you don't see trees with socks around them. So I really like that that this picture tells a story. It's kind of a language, it's a communication kind of thing going on there between the girl and the tree, I guess.
And that just shows we aren't, you know, Chris isn't, you know, super picky about how you illustrate the concept.
It's very often the idea that counts. You can always perfect the technique, but having the idea and then just doing it and participating in the assignment, that's what it's about.
But there is some actual language in this third one from Demon Sub.
Yeah, and that's a black and white picture. You see a book and a digital reader of some sort next to it. And I kind of like how Demon Sub illustrates that the book is a bit of an older thing and the digital device is something newer. And the way he did it is, well, first of all, it's black and white, which kind of takes the color away and makes it really clear what it's about. And then what he did is he gave that book side a probably artificial kind of a film grain look. So that makes it look really old. So the book and next to it, the very smooth tablet kind of computer. I kind of like the way he treated that picture and he worked on that.
Neat. Neat. Yeah. Well, there's three great pictures. Thank you, everybody, for your submissions. You can see them all on Flickr if you go to flickr.com. It's Flickr without an E, FLICKR.com. And the tech guy group there, and look for the language tag. Now, this means we need a new assignment, Chris.
I have a new assignment here. And as I have been spending 3 days with thinking about light, I want to make this assignment light, but not the light itself, but what it does to the things around it. So I want people to illustrate what light does to things. It could be a shadow, it could be a reflection, the light could wrap around something nicely. So there are lots of things that light does, and that's the assignment.
What light does to things.
Yes.
And so all you have to do is take a picture. And by the way, iPhone is fine. Camera phone is fine. Anything you've got, any camera you've got. You don't have to have a fancy camera. But do take that picture and put it up on Flickr. Flickr account's free. In fact, if you have a Yahoo account, you already have a Flickr account. Do tag it, though, with, I guess we'll use the word light, yes?
I think light will be.
Okay. So tag it with the word light, and we'll give you 4 weeks. You can upload as many as a picture a week, but you got to upload it to the Tech Guy group. You'll find the Tech Guy group by searching for Tech Space Guy in the groups section. And you'll know you're in the right one when you have almost 10,000 members, 2,389 photos. And Renee, our group admin, will welcome you. And she'll also post what the assignment is. So if you forget, that's okay. You just go right there and all the information will be there. Thank you so much, Mr. Chris Marquardt.
You're so welcome.
You'll find him at chrismarquardt.com. Actually, best thing to do is go to our website, techguylabs.com, And I'll have a link to Chris Markwart because if the spelling is complicated.
It's all European and weird.
It's all weird. Thanks, Chris. Great to talk to you. And everybody, this is a chance to get out there and take some photos. That's what we'd like you to do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Craig is the next caller on the line from Arkansas. Hi, Craig. Leo Laporte here.
Hi, Leo. Nice talking to you.
Nice to talk to you.
For a long time online.
Thank you.
Watch, I'm going to mute my TV here. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can hear the little echo back in the background.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, while you turn it down, we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll take your call. I know he wants to talk about Android. In just a bit, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We started talking to Craig in Arkansas, and I'm sorry I had to interrupt you there. Hi, Craig. Thanks for hanging on.
Oh, that's quite all right. How are you doing, Leo?
I am well.
That's good. Okay. Well, my question for you is, about 2 months ago, I purchased my first Android phone. It was the Samsung Stratosphere.
Okay.
I loved it, but it developed some problems. Verizon did a warranty exchange for it. Second device developed some problems as well. And so they've upgraded me to the HTC Resound.
All right.
You know, it seems like a decent phone. But the issue I'm having is that it will not upload anything to my Picasa account. Every time I look at an image and I select share in Picasa, it shows my account name in the little window, but it won't allow me to select a directory or an album to upload to. And when I do click the upload, it says it couldn't retrieve account information. Is this just a problem with the phone, or is there any way I can fix this?
It doesn't sound like a problem with the phone. It sounds like something's screwed up. I would try. There are programs like Picasa Tool, which is free, that will make this a little bit easier. There's Picasa Mobile as well. Maybe that's the solution. You know, you could log out of your Google Plus account or your Google account and log back in, see if that works. Do you have Google Plus on there? That's another useful tool, because once you put that on there, we'll automatically upload every picture you take to Picasa automatically.
Well, the handset doesn't give me the option to upload to Google Plus, or at least I haven't seen it.
You have to get the Google Plus app.
Okay.
It's a free app from Google. They don't automatically install it. And then when you put the Google Plus app on there, you'll log into your Google account. If you have a Google account, and obviously you do, you already have a Plus account.
Right.
You don't have to use Plus. But what happens is then, and go into the settings, you turn on the automatic upload. And your photos, as you take them, you know, in fact, Google's been advertising, isn't this cool, what a great idea. The photos, as you take them, will automatically be uploaded invisibly. Nobody can see them, just you. But then if you go to plus.google.com and click the photos link, you'll see the photos from your phone that have automatically been uploaded. And you can at that, and you can then at that point move them from album to album. But they are on Picasa. That's where Google stores them.
Okay, well, where I'm running into the issue is, a friend of mine posts something on his Facebook wall, and there's an image that I want to save. You know, in the past, I've been able to select that image, share, and then share to my Picasa, and I can't do that anymore.
That sounds like a Facebook issue, not a Google issue. So you're doing you're doing this from the Facebook app.
Well, no, it's from the app on the phone.
Right. That's the Facebook app. That's not working properly.
Okay.
So I would that sounds like it's an issue with how the permissions are set up on Facebook. So the Facebook app is just an interface to Facebook, uses the same exact permissions that are on Facebook. So I would say disconnect from Facebook, reconnect in the app on the phone. Right. And then if it still doesn't work, then you're going to want to, on your computer, go to your Facebook account and see what the permissions are. That's all that's happening. So you're saying you're in your Facebook app and you would like to take a picture from your Facebook app and put it in Picasa.
Well, it's from Facebook or any other place I happen to be on the web. It's not necessarily just Facebook.
Yeah. So the way Android works, which is kind of weird, is you add share to capability by adding an app, So when if you look at anything, you're using the share button, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that isn't Facebook. You're right. That's the built-in sharing capability. I would have you installed a Picasa app on your phone.
I didn't install it on the phone. From the moment I got the phone and I synced it with my Google, it automatically
did it.
Right.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any settings for me to change anywhere on it.
Yeah. Let me look here at. I'm actually doing it on my phone just to take a look. So I've gone into a Facebook. I've got a picture of Mark Zuckerberg and his puppy. And great, isn't that nice? And I'm going to see if I can share this. And as always happens when you press the share button on an Android phone, let's see. Let me see if I can pull this up here. You'll get a list of things that you can share to. And most of these are functionality that's been installed by installing an application. So, for instance, I see apps that I have installed in there. Do you see a Picasa choice?
Right. Under that menu right there that I'm saying you're looking
there's
at
Picasa.
Right now, I have a Picasa option.
Yeah.
And, right there.
And you see upload photo. The account is correct.
The account is correct. Under albums, it's blank. It won't let me select an album.
I see.
When I press upload, it says could not retrieve account information.
Got it. Yeah, it sounds like somehow that is. So it's working. As you see, I'm just doing it on mine. It's working on mine. I suspect there is some configuration issue. I don't think it's the phone. You might go log out of your account, log back into your Google account. Seems to me that that's part of the issue. Because if it's properly associated with it, as you can see, I see albums on my phone, and I can add an album, in fact. And that's exactly
right.
What you're not getting. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It does sound like the account info is somehow messed up. That happens sometimes on Android, where you logged in, and so it knows all your Google stuff, including your Picasa account. I would log out and log back in again, see if that something's going on there.
All right, I'll give that a try.
Yeah, I don't think it's phone specific. In other words, but I have seen things like that happen. So you want to re-authenticate. In other words, just log out of your Google account and log back in. I have a feeling it didn't get all the, connections set up properly. It's doing quite a bit if you think about it. It's fun, all those Google accounts logging you in and all that stuff. It's a nice feature, I think, of Android is that that sharing menu, just like on Windows, can be enhanced. When an application installs, it can add an item to the sharing menu. So you saw I have Dropbox, I have Box.net, I have a variety of other apps, and I can share directly to those apps. That's very handy. Picasa should be one of them, and it should work normally. Sandy, San Diego, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. How's it going?
I'm great. What can I do for you?
Well, let me take you off the speaker. Okay, cool. I'm a webmaster for several sites, and I work on a Mac. And I never, ever go to IE, but I know that it's problematic. And I wanted to know what the easiest, cheapest, whatever, most effective way for me to check my websites on IE, so either getting like a real cheap little PC Mac laptop or running Windows on my Mac or what? What do you
suggest? It depends on what you want to do. If you want to really test the site, like try clicking on things, functionality and everything, you then need to run Windows. You can do that on your Mac. You just get VirtualBox, which is free, and install that. Install Windows on your Mac, and then it won't run super fast, but it'll run plenty fast for you to see how it works. So that's running a virtual machine on the Mac, and that you have to have a copy of Windows, but other than that, it's free. There are commercial programs like Parallels and VMware Fusion that do the same thing. But if all you want to do is say, well, what does it look like in IE? There's a website called browsershots.org that will actually, if you look at it, it's kind of amazing. It's a checkboxes of all these different browsers and varieties, including every version of Internet Explorer going back through time, Chrome, Firefox. And you just check the boxes, and it'll give you images. It'll test you. So there are a number of sites that will do this, but browsershots.org is one example.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but now that doesn't give you functionality, because that's just going to give you a it'll tell you compatibility. It'll give you a snapshot.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really good, because I have one site that, like, the top row is black, and then there's text down lower, and it ends up going all the way up into the top, and so, of course, it's invisible.
Yeah.
And nobody can read it, so I want to make sure that it's readable, you know, and once it is, then the functionality usually follows, but I want people to see right up front that it's, you know, that they can read it. So.
Right. That's certainly the first place, and it's probably a CSS error. It's not unusual for CSS to be implemented in different ways in different browsers. Good luck, Sandy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, with Hank Laporte, the tech son. Hey, Hank. You're going to help me answer some calls, some tech questions. We'll help people with their computers and the internet. And you're down for that? Cell phones, camcorders. Actually, if you have any questions about electronic music creation, or Logic in particular, that's what you use, Apple's Logic? Yeah. This guy knows it all. He can make you a beat. 888 Ask Leo. That's the number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S., outside the U.S. Just use Skype out and you can call us. Cargo Plex in our chat room says, that kid is nothing but trouble.
Hey, come on now.
I'll explain how the magic of radio works a little later on, son. We're going to hand down the family business here. But first, let's say hi to Dave in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Hey, Dave. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How's it going?
It's great. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Got a pretty easy question for you, hopefully. I just got my new iPad, and my wife and son are about to go on a trip here this week, and I'd like to convert a bunch of my old Blu-rays and DVDs and get them onto my computer and into iTunes and load them up on the iPad for them.
How much time have you allotted for this?
I know it's going to take a while. I just want to get a few, but just kind of what you recommend for using for getting it all.
Yeah, so the DVDs are fairly easy because the copy protection on DVD movies was broken, you know, pretty much right away and has never been since recovered. So you're on a Mac or Windows?
Windows.
Okay. So the first thing you have to do is what we call rip. And I know sometimes people think that means rip off, but it isn't. It's rip the DVD. You're taking the bits off of the disc and putting them onto the hard drive, and then with iTunes, you'll be moving them over to the iPad.
Yeah.
There are a number of if Blu-ray's in the mix, and you're definitely going to do some Blu-ray discs.
Yeah.
You're going to need to buy some software, and the good news is the software you buy will do both Blu-ray and the regular DVDs. If you didn't have to do Blu-ray, I would say go out and get the free Handbrake. It'll do it. It's free. It's easy. You do that plus VLC and you can rip it. But Blu-ray is a little trickier. And frankly, the only company I know that can rip Blu-rays is called Slysoft. And the only reason they're not out of business is because they do business out of, I think, Trinidad.
Okay.
But they have a program that will rip Blu-ray DVDs. It's called AnyDVD HD. And you'll use that to take the contents of the DVD off, put it on the hard drive. You'll have to encode it in a way that iTunes and the iPad can support. So you may still end up getting Handbrake, because Handbrake has a iPad setting. And so it knows exactly what the iPad can handle. And you kind of want to make sure it's in that mode. So Handbrake, which is free, is handbrake.fr, Windows or Mac. Handbrake.fr. It's an open source program. It doesn't know about removing copy protection. They decided they didn't want to get sued out of existence by the movie industry. So they allow you to download another program, VLC, which is from videoland.org. And if you have VLC installed, Handbrake will, in fact, rip DVDs. But if you're using the Slysoft's HD, then you don't have to worry about removing copy protection, because that, in the process, removes copy protection.
Okay.
Now you're not gonna put these on the internet and distribute them. You're not gonna put a blanket out front. No, this is just to take movies you've already purchased that you own and convert them in such a way that you can put them on the iPad.
Yeah, the ones I tried to buy, I tried to get the digital copy, but they don't all have that. And now I've been pretty much buying stuff on iTunes and whatnot, so it's all there wherever I need it. So I'm just trying to get some of the old stuff onto there.
So you hear that when I say, you know, the folks at Handbrake didn't want to get sued, it's technically, at least in the U.S., I don't know what the laws are in Canada, I suspect it's exactly the same, illegal to do this. But as far as I'm concerned, ethically and morally, all you're doing is taking something you own and putting it on something else you own. You're not giving it away. You're not distributing it. Not pirating it.
Exactly.
So, in my opinion, that's fine.
Services you can, they're trying to put in so you can buy, you can pay more money to convert your stuff you've already bought and then get it onto
digital copy. They don't want you to remove the copy protection. They don't want you to rip it. They want you to buy another copy of the movie.
Yeah.
So just so you understand, nobody's going to come to your house. The Mounties or the Royal Canadian Mounted Police will not ride up to your door. But you could get sued. That has happened. Although I understand the Hurt Locker lawsuit has been dropped, which is I think probably good news. The folks who made Hurt Locker were understandably hurt because it was being pirated on the BitTorrent sites, and so they decided to sue every single person who ever had anything to do with that. And it was kind of a fruitless search anyway. And they had 20,000 plus defendants, and they've all been the case has been dismissed. So I think it's probably not anything you should worry about. I just wanted to, you know, comply with my fiduciary responsibility to keep you from going to jail, to inform you that it is technically illegal. I see nothing wrong with doing something like this. It's, as far as I'm concerned, morally ethical. Because you own it. You bought it. Just don't do anything wrong. You know, morally wrong. Don't put it on don't burn DVDs and put them on a blanket in your front lawn. That kind of thing. That would be wrong. Don't give them to your friends. If your friends say, hey, you know, can I have that movie? No, you got to buy it, dude. You like the movies? You like seeing movies? You want to support the movie industry? Buy it. That's fair. Let's talk about backup, and then we'll get on with the show. I got more calls. That was Dave in Calgary. The next is Ron in West Hollywood. And we'll talk to Ron about, he says, integrating video into one channel. No idea what that means, but we'll find out when we talk to him. Before we do, though, let's talk about backing up your data. You do have a lot of data on your disk. I would say the data that matters the most is the stuff you made, your pictures of your baby being born or your wedding or your daughter's wedding, your financial records, all the stuff that you just cannot afford to lose. It's all there on that hard drive on that computer. Let's go to West Hollywood. Ron is on the line. Hi, Ron. Leo Laporte.
Leo.
You don't work in the movie industry, do you?
Used to.
I could be in deep trouble. You're one of the people who lost their jobs thanks to piracy.
Not a mole, Leo. That's good. Hey, listen, I've got a question about codecs. I'm over computerized. I've got, you know, many, many computers, but I just bought a new Apple top of the line, and I want to put integrate everything onto the Apple.
All right. I'll help you do that after the break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. One of my son's songs, actually. Something he did in Logic, actually on spec. You hear that? That's the one for This Week in Google, right? He says he doesn't like it. Don't play it anymore. Kyle Benham, our musical director, likes it.
I'd have a much better version if he'd post it online.
Post it online. He says post it online, Hank. You got to
put
the better one on SoundCloud, all right?
SoundCloud makes everything.
Leo, he says he doesn't like SoundCloud. The quality is cloudy, goes down, huh?
Audio goes,
all right. He's got a golden ear now, you know. When you become an audio producer, everything has to be just so. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We were talking, and I'm sorry we had to interrupt our little conversation, Ron, before the break, about moving everything off of all these other systems onto your Mac. Right, Ron?
That's it. Okay, here we are back again.
We're back again,
Leo, I've been following you for years. Years
Thank
and
you.
Years and years. longer since the Tech Guy days, and love you. Listen to you every weekend. For how many hours? I don't know.
God knows. Anyway, too many.
too many. Hours. And I, you know, but you've little bits of wisdom that you've passed my way. Have been thoroughly utilized, and I'm an ESET guy and DSL Extreme and on and on.
Well,
but here's the deal. Codecs. I've migrated to Apple, and I have a couple of Apple computers. I just bought a new one, a desktop. Anyway, I want to put everything that I have. I have a lot of video. Anyway, to get it over onto the Apple computer, and it's no problem if Apple has the codecs that I need for my, and most of it's like Canon video or just stills, which are on Picasa, which I can move over very easily. But I have this little RCA. It's called the Little Wonder. And the Little Wonder is supposed to be downloaded on Media Center. Well, that's great. But Apple doesn't...
Ain't no Media Center on the Mac, is there?
Yeah, no Media Center on the Mac. So they said, go take VLC, which I downloaded, religiously. But how do you go from VLC to iMovie so I can throw it all together?
So the first thing we got to figure out is what is this Little Wonder recording into?
You're going to ask me that. The Little Wonder is made by RCA, and it basically took the place of the flip phone, which is no longer in production.
So now I got to figure out what codec it is. I don't, you know, if RCA used a proprietary codec, which I bet it did, they come out as AVI files.
AVI 264 was an AVI, but they're using their own 260 version of 264, whatever that means. I have no idea.
Yeah, so I can explain that. So first, let me explain for those listening what a codec is. It's short for compression decompression, and video is so big, so fat, so ginormous, so you have to compress it, or you just can't store it. You know, uncompressed video would fill your hard drive in seconds.
Sure.
So we compress all video, even high quality video is compressed, and then of course to play it back, you have to decompress it. The problem is it's a Tower of Babel. There's an almost infinite number of codecs, compressor decompressors out there. The standard is now H.264, and Apple actually can get some, and Microsoft, but somewhat more Apple, can get some credit for this. They've been promoting H.264 as a standard for a long time. It's a good standard. It gives you very high-quality video at low bit rates, relatively low bit rates. It's great for streaming because you can make one version of H.264, and it will stream at a variety of different rates and adjust appropriately. We use it for all the video. If you download any of the video of my shows, it's all in H.264, and I think going forward, almost everything will be. So here's the good news. Making this a vanilla H.264 will be a good thing. You won't have to do this again, even if you move off Mac.
Okay.
So in fact, I would say, in general, you want to store video in H.264. What you need is you got to find something that will read this modified H.264 AVI file and convert it into a format, usually M4V. That's the Apple type format. Those are QuickTime movies in H.264. And there are a lot of different ways to do this. We mentioned Handbrake earlier. That's a free program that does a great job. If Handbrake will read these RCA files, and I don't know if it will because I'm not sure, but at least you could try it.
Okay.
So handbrake.fr.
Got that.
And it has, it makes it as easy as possible. It has a lot of settings. You can mess around and do all sorts of crazy things to it. But basically, the basic default settings, you just say, well, what are you outputting for? And I would say, well, I'm going to output it for an iPad 3, or I want to output it for best quality iTunes, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And it will automatically put it in exactly the format that's right for that output device.
So how do you compare that with the VLC, which, of course, if you go to the Mac store, that's what they're promoting.
Well, VLC is also free. In fact, VLC and Handbrake go hand in hand. What VLC will open those files, but it won't transcode them in most cases.
Okay.
So what you want to do is, it's not just watching the video. Can you watch it in VLC?
Yeah.
Good. Then it's almost
certain. No, I can watch. You know what I can watch? It's a whole stream of audio and video, and I can watch the video. It picks up the video parts, but I want to be able to download the audio also, which is it's integral to what I'm doing. I'm trying to put this whole.
Are they not in the same file?
Yeah, it's all together. It's all, you know.
So you're saying I can see it, but I don't hear the audio?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that's another issue because
it picks up the video shots, but it doesn't pick up the audio.
Okay, so that's another issue because there are audio codecs as well. So H.264 is not an audio codec. It's just video. You'll also have, in any given file, an audio codec, and I guess that RCA is using some sort of weird audio codec. Boy, if you can't play it back on VLC with both audio and video in sync, it must be a very strange format. Because VLC is pretty good. VLC, you can export to a limited number of formats, so you can do transcoding. It's just not as capable or as easy to use. I would cross your fingers. Open it. Get Handbrake. It's free. Handbrake.fr. See if Handbrake will open it and transcode it into a format that's appropriate for your Mac. If it won't, then you're going to have to do a little bit more digging. Handbrake is a front end to a command line tool that can handle almost any codec in the world called FFmpeg. FFmpeg is fantastic, but it's a command line tool, and it's really complicated to use. There used to be some really great front ends to it. Visual Hub was an amazing program, which they just stopped making, and I think it was the movie industry, frankly, that put Visual Hub out of business. So, I think first thing to do, see if Handbrake will do it. You've got VLC. It's good to have both. They're both free. VLC is available from videoland.org. Handbrake is handbrake.fr. Both are from France, oddly enough. And they work very well hand in hand. The audio is what's concerning me a little bit. That means there's some odd audio codec. You're going to figure that out. I think a Google of RCA Little Wonder Macintosh will probably find what you need. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And Toronto Mario says, I better start my coffee now so I have it in the morning. You're right. You're right. I got to start brewing it now. 8888 Ask Leo. Lots of help, really good help from our chat room on this issue of this little weird. And boy, this is why I would be careful about what you record your video with. Little weird RCA device. Apparently records video in DivX format and audio in MPEG 1, which I would guess is really MPEG 1 layer 3 or MP3 format. MP3 shouldn't be a problem. That's a pretty common audio format, obviously. DivX a little more complicated. It's MPEG 1 layer 2. Oh, there you go. That's actually what we use right now. When I'm talking to you over MPEG layer 2, and NPR likes to use MPEG 1 layer 2. So it's a high quality audio format. But that is going to be complicated. This is the problem. It's truly a Tower of Babel. You have formats all over the place, all complicated stuff. Hey, a couple of days ago, actually last week, we talked a little bit about home theater setups. And I talked about, with our home theater whiz, Scott Wilkinson, I talked about buying some screen paint called Screen Goo to paint my wall to make a giant screen home theater. And I got a call from an old friend, Ron Rosberg, who is a gadget guru from way, way back, was a regular on this show for many years, who says he found an easier way to do it. Ron's on the line with us right now. Are you in your home in Clear Lake, Ron?
In the Technology Lake House. If you remember correctly, I was your first guest, a full-time guest every week, and you said you'll never have guests on there.
I know. I don't like having guests. I do. I don't. I like to just monopolize the dang thing.
Anyway, so, yes, you and Scott were talking about that, and I wanted to give you some of my experience and so you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
I love it. So a lot of people think and talk about big-screen TVs, plasma versus LCD and all that, but there is this third way to go, this projection way to do it.
Well,
and
let me give you a quick synopsis of what I do. I thought about the Screen Goo also. And then when I found out it's really tricky to apply, you've got to be kind of a real good painter. I'm not, okay? So I would have to bring in pros to, yeah. and the masking and all the other stuff I would have had to do. The project would have run me about $700 or $800. The paint itself is like $250 or whatever,
right.
$260.
Right. But then you have to hire somebody unless you're really adept.
Do it. And yeah. I was thinking of you and Henry doing it. No, it ain't going to work.
No.
All the TV you watch and all the audio books you listen to, you don't have 10 minutes to paint your wall.
I'm not a painter. No, you're right,
right.
Ron.
Okay. What? Anyway, so here's what the first thing I did. I went on eBay. And I bought some screen material. Okay, I said, okay, I know I'll be able to do this. I was talking to Stewart Film Screen, who makes really some good screens. They wanted $5,000. They were going to give me a better deal because of the technology house. But $5,000 for a 11-foot screen.
Crazy,
it was just
crazy,
expensive.
Yeah.
So I bought the eBay material. It was $120, including delivery, for a 11-foot screen.
Now, it's not the holder or anything. It's just the fabric.
Just the fabric. Then I had two guys try to stretch it onto $80 worth of material, and it took 4 hours times two, 8 hours. So the total project, not even including the velvet, which I never got to make it really finished, was going to be around $700. Well, Monoprice, and I know you talked about them last week.
You told me about Monoprice.
I introduced Monoprice on your show about 6-7 years ago, okay,
yes.
When you first started. Anyway, they had told me about their projection screens, but unfortunately at the time they said, Ron, it's going to be about 6 months, and I didn't want to wait 6 months. Well, meantime, after I got this whole screen built, and I wasn't thrilled with it, I finally said, hey, Monoprice, I'm going to order the 11-foot screen, which was, listen to this, $480. For their screen, Leo, took 2 hours to assemble, which was phenomenal because all the aluminum frame on it has, like, sliding hooks on it, and it gives you arrows to exactly where the hooks go, so the material is stretched beautifully. They also had motorized units, but I didn't want motorized. So I watched yesterday for, 5 hours, the final four on 11-foot screen, which is, and I defy Scott to come on up here and check my system out. I also bought an Optima 1080p projector on sellout Woot, which has them every once in a while. They're refurbished for $649.
Now, I got to explain. Ron, for many years, was the owner of a very well-known place in the Bay Area.
Still the owner, Leo. RepoDepot.com.
He still owns the darn thing. He can't do anything with it. This guy is a famous cheapskate going way back, right?
Absolutely.
The king of Repo Depot. But this sounds good. And so the Optima you got from Woot, when it was...
I got the Optima from Woot. It's a 1080p, and I tell you, I am thrilled to death with it. You could buy bulbs, by the way. You know, they'll run 3,000 to 4,000 hours, which will give you about... If you watched it 8 or 10 hours a day, you're going to get 3 years out of it, so you don't have to worry about the bulb. But bulbs on eBay are like $139 for replacement. So you can build a home... You could build this cheaper, Leo, then you can go out and buy a big screen. Now, by the way, Monoprice, I did talk to him. If anyone wants a Monoprice projector, they'll use the code MONOSCREEN, M-O-N-O, screen, 10% off for a week on anything they want on projection screens. And I just highly, I think it's fantastic.
I'm going to do this. I'm not going to paint. Thank goodness you sent me an email, and I canceled my screen goo order. And yeah. I'm gonna order it because I like Monoprice. I trust them.
No, I tell you, Leo, I invite you and Henry come on up and
we'll go to the lake house.
Spend a weekend here at the Technology Lake House, and my website, clearlake.org, with the resort. I put the house where you and Henry celebrated his birthday. You remember
that?
It
was his 13th birthday. We will never forget. It was so much fun.
Right.
And
my website, Leo, if anyone wants to see pictures, I got 4,000 pictures of building this house or whatever.
So the house is done because you were just starting. You took us up on a hill and showed us a stake in the ground.
3 years, 3 years to get done, Leo. But ronphotos.notlong.com is the website if they want to check out the pictures.
Ronphotos.notlong.com. And what is the Clear Lake?
ClearLake.org is the website for the vacation rental.
ClearLake.org. And Monoprice.
But, this is a way to go. It's fabulous. I mean, the total price, listen to this, if someone bought the same screen I bought, including the freight, by the way, they could all go to Rancho Cucamonga is where Monoprice is located. So if they're Southern California people, they can go to Monoprice and pick it up there, save the freight. It's $135 freight.
Wow. And MonoScreen is the 10% off deal.
MonoScreen is the code from starting today.
We're going to start a new show with Ron Rosberg called This Week in Cheap.
I'd be happy to. I got all, you know, I got control systems, Leo. I got the Kohler digital shower. I've got a really technology lake house up here.
Ron, you're the greatest. It's so good to hear from you.
Send me his email address, Leo, and I'll send the link for you.
Okay, will do.
Okay, we'll do. Ronald@USA.net.
Ronald@USA.net. Ron Rosberg, it's great to hear from you again. You just saved me a bunch of money. Actually, you didn't, because now I have to go out and spend even more money, but that's okay. That's okay.
It's not going to be more money because you're not going to stay and paint. I know you and Henry.
I don't have to hire painters. That's always a good thing.
Exactly.
Thank you, Ron.
You're welcome. Great talking to you.
Is Repo Depot for sale? Can I buy that too?
Repo Depot is for sale. RepoDepot.com is for sale. I've been trying to say, if anyone wants a business, please call me.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Ron, you're the greatest. Oh, man, he cracks me up. It's the Frugal Song. Let's say you want some bread. This is my new show, This Week in Cheap. I think it'd be a big hit, don't you think? I like it. John in Pasadena, California, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, John.
Leo?
You? Yes.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
That's me. Sure, what can I do for you?
Okay, a couple of months ago, I got into buying domain names, and I was wondering, can you advise me? I want to make money off them, and what would you suggest, like putting them in auction or?
Yeah. So what, give me an example of a domain you own.
Well, you just mentioned coffee. I have the domain name Tchaikovsky's.
Tchaikovsky's.
Tchaikovsky.
Tchaikov. Yeah, that's good. I can give you a buck for that. I think this must be an April Fool's joke. I know he's going to say Baba Booey if I keep on going, right? Tom in Riverside, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Tchaikovsky's. Hey, Tom. Leo Laporte. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. What can I do for you?
Yeah, that was funny.
I like it. I think I'd buy that. Tchaikovsky's.
Yeah, you give him a dollar for it.
I'll give you a buck.
Anyway, I have a question on scanning. I've heard you speak on scanning photographs many times, but what I'm doing is scanning in black and white documents. And when I get them, if I put the black and white up high enough to get good, clean font, I got black dots all over my documents.
Right.
So I have to spend lots of time erasing out to get a good, clean document. Is there any way around that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if you think about it really is a photography problem, right? The problem is that with the automated software, when you turn up contrast real high, it starts to pick up, something that would normally be kind of gray and and pump it up. So what you want to do is it depends on the software you're using. Big Ginge has it. He's in our chat room. He says you need something called D-Screen.
D-Screen?
D-Screen. It really depends on the software you're using. What kind of scanner is it?
It's a Canon scanner, and it has, it's called ScanGear.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good stuff. There is a third-party program that is designed to do a little better than the stuff that comes with your scanner. It's called ViewScan. You can try it free for 30 days. And I would try this and see if you can use its settings to bring up the contrast. Uh-huh. It's actually, what you want is actually pretty easy to do, because what you have to do is the screen sets a level for, is it black or white? You need to have some software that says, am I going to make this dot on the screen be black, or am I going to make this dot white? If it's below a certain level, even if there's, you know, some gray there, it will make it white. If it's above a certain level, it'll make it black. You'll get the crispest possible by doing that. But that's a little smarter than just turning up contrast, right?
I see.
So you need to de-screen. Anyway, ViewScan is available for free from Hamrick for 30 days.
Hamrick?
Hamrick, HAMRICK.com. And okay. So do it. I would say do it in monochrome, you know, black or white, and do it in a high DPI.
Uh-huh.
And then you want the de-screening, which will take out anything that's not sufficiently black to be an actual character.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's totally doable.
Years ago, I got a another scanner that had a paperport product.
Yes,
that was made by.
They're very good.
Yeah, and it had a button that said remove stray dots, and I would push on
cool.
And that worked really good. That was like 6.5, and I bought their product later, and they still had that button. It just didn't work.
Oh.
You know, if you push the button, not only would it remove the dots, but it would also fray the font.
Right.
And make them all raggedy.
Yeah, so if it doesn't it make sense what I just said, which is you want a kind of a level beyond which, if it's dark enough, you say keep it. If it's not
right.
dark enough, you just get rid of it. D-screen, many programs will have a D-screen setting. If it does have it, turn it on, see if that Canon software will do what you want.
Okay.
And if not, go get ViewScan. It's from Hamrick. And then there's a nice little, really actually pretty useful little page you might want to take a look at, scantips.com, that is just kind of scanning 101. And it talks about, I think, things like, yeah, it does. It talks about de-screening and things like that.
What was the first word of that, Anne?
Scan.
Like, the lady's name, Anne, A-N-N?
No, scan, like a scanner.
Oh, scan. Okay, I didn't
yeah, scantips.com.
Scan tips, okay.
Yeah, I think that's going to help you understand what's going on with your scanner. What you want to do is totally doable. The reason the paperport did such a good job of it is it was designed specifically for optical character recognition, for taking a page of text and turning it into editable text. And that's exactly the kind of thing it needs to do, is say, well, is this a letter or just a, is this just, you know, a dot on the page. It's and so D-screen is one thing that will help you turn that on for sure. We're going to take a break. Come back. I got more calls. I'm not done. Saul in Redondo Beach went from film to digital. What are you going to do with the old negatives? He says, well, maybe I can help you. What can I do for you, Saul?
Well, I finally was at the right place at the right moment, and I found myself a digital camera kit, two lenses and a body. It's an older model, but it was brand new in the box.
Great.
And I switched to digital.
Yay.
So what do I do with my old negatives as far as scanning and saving them? Or
Well, I would save them for sure. If you know, if you've been all along kind of pruning them so that you know that there's a set of, say, you know, a few hundred or a few thousand that are absolute keepers, then you might want to scan them in. Scanning is either time-consuming if you do it yourself or costly if you have somebody else do it. So you don't want to scan more than you need, but so you don't want to scan every negative you ever did.
I already pretty much sorted out what I want to keep. So
good.
What should I be looking for on a scanning device?
Before you get there, Saul, let me tell you, it's very time consuming. Most scanners, I use an Epson Perfection. They have a negative scanning capability because a scanner to scan negatives can't be the same kind of scanner that you'd scan a sheet of paper with, because if you think about it, a scanner that scans a sheet of paper is bouncing light off the paper. To get a negative, you don't want to bounce light off it. You need to shine light through it like a slide projector. So you need a scanner that has light in the lid as well as light underneath. A negative holder would be nice, too. The Epson Perfection series will do this. They do a very good job, but I don't recommend it because it takes you about a minute to do five. How many do you have?
That's what I've noticed. That they emphasize a lot of.
It takes a long time.
They emphasize that it's all manual operated. That's correct.
Yep.
And I have about, I'd say, 400 or 500 left that I.
Well, that's not too bad. That's not too bad. You could do that over a period of months. You know, just every time you had some time, you could do that. And then it's a simple thing to turn a negative into a positive in Photoshop, or and even the scanning software probably has that capability.
Well, let me rephrase that. I have about 450 rolls of film.
Oh, that's a little different. Multiply by 36. I would use a service. Much easier. They do it faster. They do a great job. They clean the negatives. That's what I did. It's best. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.